You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hi, I'm going to whisper some things to you now about Crunch chocolate bars. Because apparently this whispering thing is a thing that makes you feel things. It's saying something crunchy is coming in the candy wrapper language. Imagine your tongue hiking up those crispy, rocky ridges. Now, drum roll, please.
Wow, that's good. Crunchy, munchy chocolate doesn't whisper.
Turn up the fun with Crunch.
This episode is brought to you by Beyond Natural Pet Food. Beyond Pet Food helps me care for what matters, my pets and my world. They help me nourish my pets with high-quality natural ingredients, like wild-caught salmon and organic free-range chicken. Beyond also has responsible sourcing practices and a long-term partnership with the Nature Conservancy. Beyond Pet Food, your pet, your world. Learn more at beyondpetfood.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
Do you believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome back to The Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and the way it's shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Tasha Robinson, here again with
Genevieve Kosky,
Scott Tobias,
Keith Phipps.
In the first half of this conversation, we talked about Christopher Nolan's breakthrough Memento, about a man pursuing his wife's killer, even though he's incapable of remembering what he's doing for more than about 15 minutes at a time. It was the first thing we thought of when we were watching Pixar's Finding Dory, which is also about a character with profound memory problems, trying to put together pieces from her past to find her family. Finding Dory is the sequel to 2003's Finding Nemo, one of Pixar's all-time greatest hits, and it shares a lot of Nemo's structure as well as some of its characters. In Nemo, a clownfish named Marlin, voiced by Albert Brooks, crosses the ocean looking for his kidnapped son. In Finding Dory, the focus shifts to Marlin's awkward but good-natured new fish friend, Dory, who also has anterograde amnesia and can't make new memories. When a series of flashbacks reminds Dory of her missing parents, she has to cross the ocean yet again to look for them, in another big adventure full of chases, colorful characters, and a message about living with disability.
My family! I remember my family! They're out there somewhere. Have to find them! Guys, you gotta help me, guys!
Dory!
Where did you go?
You were the one to go!
My parents! I remember them!
Wait, what did you remember?
I remember them! My mom, my dad! I have a family! They don't know where I am. Let's go!
Dory,
we have to go!
No! No! This is crazy! Where exactly are you trying to go?
To the gym of the, Baltic?
The Jewel of Morro Bay, California!
Yes!
No, Dory, California's all the way across the ocean.
Then we better get going!
How come every time we're on the edge of this reef, one of us is trying to leave? For once, can't we just enjoy the view?
How can you be talking about the view when I remembered my family?
No, no! We've done our ocean travels. That part of our lives is over. The only reason to travel in the first place is so you don't have to travel ever again.
Yeah, but I wanna...
So, starting with the obvious, what did you guys think of Finding Dory? Did it compare to Finding Nemo? And most importantly, did you cry?
It's all right.
I didn't cry, which kind of makes me cry because
you didn't cry.
Yeah, I think it might be the first Pixar movie that I haven't cried at. I haven't seen the Cars movies, but yeah, like
the Good Dinosaur, even for you,
the Good Dinosaur got a couple tears out of it. Mm-hmm. I believe I'm on this podcast saying that it made me a little misty, but this, yeah, and I think part of it is, I love Finding Nemo. It's not my favorite Pixar, but it's definitely up there. But I was never a huge Dory fan to begin with. So I was always approaching this sequel with a little bit of trepidation for that reason. And this movie did make me care about Dory. So in that aspect, it was a success. And I mean, it's good. It's a good Pixar. It's solid, like, tier two Pixar for me, you know,
but not two tiers Pixar.
Yeah, no. It's a zero tier, second tier Pixar. And honestly, like, because going into this, I'm like, okay, well, even if, you know, the story doesn't do it for me, it's going to be beautiful, like, because Finding Nemo was beautiful. And I mean, it looked really good, but there wasn't that moment that, like, even how with the good dinosaur was like, wow, this is, like, kind of incredible. Like, it looked very similar to Finding Nemo, and there wasn't a lot of interesting stuff going on visually for me there, with one, like, kind of minor exception, which we can talk about.
Well, I mean, you know what was going, what was interesting visually was Piper, the short film that was before the movie, which is a total delight and had those hyper realistic images where you're like, wow, this is just the next front in animation. But you're right, the look of the film, I guess maybe for continuity's sake, perhaps, it looks a lot like Finding Nemo, and really the film feels like Finding Nemo again. It's like we're crossing the ocean, and, you know, there's a lot of misadventures and laughs, and I mean, it's fine, but it is a retread, you know, and that was disappointing. I think in terms of the crying factor, maybe the bit with the shells, all the shells that Dory's parents have been studiously laying out for however long. I can't say all these years. It's not all these years, is it? How long do these fish live anyway?
You know, that actually raises a question that really lingered for me, which is, there is a very specific reason, very well told at the beginning of Finding Nemo, why Marlin has one child and no more children and no wife. I'm really kind of bugged by the idea that Dory's parents had one kid and, like, never had any more kids and, like, lived their life waiting for this one kid to come back. They're fish. Come on.
Yeah, but also they have eyelids.
Yeah, I it's weird. Finding Nemo, I like a lot, but it was always kind of second tier Pixar to me. And revisiting it kind of confirmed that for me. I mean, I do really like the film, but it's never been my favorite Pixar film. But I do like Dory a lot. I mean, I the character, I think it's, like, really one of the great pairings of character design and voice. I think Ellen DeGeneres is delightful as that character. I didn't necessarily want a whole movie about her, but I assumed that they had a really great, different kind of story to tell when this movie was announced. And yeah, it's all right.
I mean, I think, you know, and this, I'm certainly not the first person to make this point, Tasha. You even kind of mentioned it at the beginning there. But I do think it's interesting that it is telling a story about living with a disability. Mm-hmm. And that is something different and kind of, I guess, a little groundbreaking for Pixar. So, and I do think it handled it in a pretty good way. And going back to, like, my dislike of Dory, or my not love of Dory, is in Finding Nemo, she was very much kind of like a one joke character, you know, like she didn't remember what happened 3 seconds ago. Haha. Mm-hmm. And Finding Dory uses that one joke a lot in the beginning, and when it starts to get away from that joke and, like, she does start to recover her memories, I found myself liking it a lot more. But, you know, it still uses that one joke a lot.
I think the best parts of the movie are Dory's parents. So Eugene, I mean, I felt like we were seeing something a little different from the first film there, with Eugene Levy and Diane Keaton as her parents, and the whole nervousness of the scene where they kind of despair as to whether or not she'll ever be able to live in the world with her condition. And that's as close as it came to really getting me, but didn't quite get me either.
I mean, I would think as a parent that would kind of touch you guys a little more, just because there's such a visible discrepancy between the faces that they present to her, the, like, relentlessly upbeat, hopeful, you can do this, it's going to be okay faces, versus how they talk in private about their concern about whether their special needs child is ever going to have a functional life.
You know, actually, now that you just mention it, I would love a film that isn't about finding anybody. that is about that relationship. Wouldn't it be cool if we just made a film about Dory and her parents
with Dory?
Well, just any. I mean, you can find some sort of plot around it. And it's out of line for me to talk to filmmakers about what they should do. But those are the most.
Scott.
Sorry,
you I'm not shouldn't
doing
do
it.
That.
I'm not doing that right now.
Let's
but
tell
I am.
You
say,
how
but
you
I,
should
but
podcast.
I think you are locating a more proper emotional. Center or anchor to this film, which has to do with Dory and her parents. I mean, that was the moment with the shells that kind of got to me. It's like that, and those were like little achievements too they could be happy about or proud of Dory for making those connections, just to be, the shells are part of it, and just being able to recognize that's how you get home, is that you follow these shells, and that's a breakthrough when they get through with her. So when you get to that theme of disability, I mean, that's a very I think quite beautiful illumination of that theme.
The thing about the shells, I mean, the shells was the one place in the movie where I also choked up. And I think it's because it does that thing that I've always said is like Pixar's signature, is what it does best, is find an emotional moment and hold on it and let it sink in and let the audience marinate in it and feel what it is. I mean, it's the trash compactor in Toy Story 3 where they all think they're going to die. It's the moment in The Incredibles when Mr. Incredible thinks his family is dead. Pixar has a way of like lingering in these moments. And the Finding Dory moment isn't that kind of moment of like violence or sadness. It's a moment of like growing hope and realization. But it's a silent moment where the audience is allowed to understand what's going on and draw their own conclusions. And that's what made it an emotional moment for me.
Kind of pivoting off of that idea of like holding on a moment, this is a little different, but it goes into what I alluded to earlier about like one interesting visual thing I think this movie does, which is kind of playing with the murkiness of water.
Absolutely.
And there are a couple of really interesting shots where she's just looking out into cloudy green nothingness, or the kelp scene, and like that is haunting in a way, especially in the context of being lost, of being lost mentally, as well as physically. So visually speaking, those were the parts that stood out most to me. And it kind of does use that same tactic of kind of holding on this moment of not necessarily discomfort, but, an emotional response.
Yeah, there were some really conscious decisions made in this film about how to handle water. Immediately after I watched it, I went back and rewatched Finding Nemo, and I had forgotten how complicated the water is in that film. Like, there are perpetually, like, these little floating specks of, impurity or, just little fragments of who knows what floating through the water. And the water is very, very textured in a way that, when you're looking for it, probably can't help but think this must have been really complicated to animate. They made a lot of choices here. But it's a very different thing from the murk in Finding Dory, which looks less show-offy and like less visually obvious, but possibly was more complicated to do because they're playing playing with opacity in complicated CGI animation. I am given to understand is a really, really complicated thing.
And the light, the way the light works in that.
I mean, that's the thing with Pixar. It's like, what's the rendering time on this movie? Toy Story, where they were talking about how long it took for those images to process, and I think they really do want to try to push the envelope visually. It's good that you mentioned how subtly they do it here, because even like I said, the short beforehand was a little more obviously wowing in terms of pushing the photorealistic limits of what computer animation can do.
At the same time, I had the same reaction Genevieve did watching this movie. There was nothing that visually stood out for me in terms of wow, that's really incredible that they were able to do that. And so I went looking after the fact, like online, to see like was there something that they're particularly proud of here? Was there a big breakthrough? And the breakthrough was in the rendering time. the big breakthroughs on this film are all like technological behind the scenes, new versions of their suites. And they've got like a whole new suite for handling light that lets them handle like complicated direct and indirect light sources in a completely different way that vastly reduces the rendering time, which is great for them, but means we don't watch the film and think, oh my God, Sully's fur, that's the most amazing thing. Oh my God, the water in the Good Dinosaur. Like, I didn't see anything that show-offy here. And apparently Hank's tentacles, Hank the octopus, who has seven tentacles and therefore is a septopus, was the most complicated character they've ever done. But on screen, it's a technological thing. Like on screen, I don't know about you guys, but I wasn't sitting there thinking, oh my God, that those tentacles. I was just thinking, hey, look at the funny octopus doing octopus things.
I like the octopus.
Octopus is good.
Yeah.
What do you like about the octopus?
I don't know. It's like Dory, I felt like the appearance of the character matched the personality, and it was Ed O'Neill was really good as that, and you know, it worked for me.
I felt myself distracted by the fact that Hank was so obviously a necessity, and like him being an octopus was a necessity in the story, which finding Dory, much more of it takes place in the human world. A big part of it is in this sea life rehabilitation center / aquarium.
It's sort of a fantasy sea world, like what sea world ought to be, which is you know really
well.
Really
it started
kind
out
and responsible.
It started out in the story as Sea World, and then the animators watched Blackfish and said, "Oh, we can't do that."
Yeah.
So they turned it into this weird fantasy.
But I mean, there's a fair amount of this movie where fish are navigating spaces where fish can't survive, and they need an octopus who can carry them around in a bucket of water or something.
Oh, man,
and
that drove me crazy.
Or a bird.
Yeah, or a bird. And like I like that part of the movie at the seaquarium more than I like everything else, just because it was something different, and like I liked kind of navigating that different space. But I was very distracted by the mechanics of it, like how you move these characters through this space. Like, oh, there are pipes, you know, and oh, they can talk to each other through the pipes. You know, it felt a little forced, but at the same time, I enjoyed exploring that space.
I never want to be like the nitpicky types. Like the comic book artist John Byrne, who's kind of in some ways a ridiculous internet presence who gripes about everything. But I remember a post to his where he complained about cars because why would a world of anthropomorphic cars have door handles? And like it's like just you know, let it go. But at the same time, I did find myself constantly distracted in a way I was not distracted in Finding Nemo by why would an octopus be able to read that? Why would a fish know how to steer a car? You know, this is...
Why would a fish know the difference between septa and octo prefixes, especially if that fish can't make new memories?
It just pushed credulity.
Oh, here's the thing that got me.
Yeah.
Seawater to freshwater. There's like how much time does Dory spend in freshwater? It's like you are not going to survive in that. You are sea. You need the salt.
That is a valid point, Scott Tobias.
I find myself suddenly reviewing every moment of the movie. I mean, she jumps from aquarium to aquarium. When he ladles her out into the coffee pot, he just takes some of her aquarium water.
Oh, yeah, just water.
Like,
you know?
No, but it's from the aquarium. It's not tap water.
There's tap water in this thing. I'm serious.
At one point, doesn't she end up in a dirty, like, janitor mop water?
Right, exactly. She's in a janitor's mop bucket. That's not seawater.
Wow, you guys were paying more attention than I was.
Unless he's a competent janitor.
Yeah, you know what? Why would they need door handles?
Wait.
Think about it.
Unless he's an incompetent janitor and he's just walking around with a bucket of seawater. Sorry, I need a moment to completely lose it over that. What exactly does the incompetent janitor just like dipping buckets of water out of the sea? Or is he like dumping entire aquariums into it? What is the scenario where the incompetent janitor has seawater in his bucket? No, that's really perfect. No, it didn't occur to me at all.
See, that made you cry.
Seriously, I'm tearing up here.
Well, I mean, I think that
lazy. Maybe he just dip in.
Right, the seawater is right there. He probably has to walk to a sink.
And apparently, those whales can just jump out of their tanks at any time.
Yeah, right. Yeah, really. Is there a lot of tank to tank action in aquariums?
Like... Never cross the tanks.
I mean, there is for octopi or octopuses. I know.
Septopi.
You know, can I just say it doesn't really matter whether you say octopuses or octopi. Somebody on the internet will get super mad at you. It doesn't matter which you use.
Yeah,
you're gonna be a target either way.
This is called squids. I did like the squid, the squid chase, which was very obvious retread of the shark sequence in Finding Nemo, except that we didn't actually get to meet and talk to the squid at the end. But I did think that was. It's a thrilling chase sequence and a nice reveal of that menace.
And it honored my favorite animal, which is the sea otter. Sea otters get to use their adorableness, yes, for good.
Okay, while we're nitpicking here, mm-hmm, did any of you guys read David Chen's piece over at, hi David, we're talking about you again, David Chen's piece over at Slash Film about the dichotomy in this film between speaking and non-speaking characters? Like, did it bug you at all that, like, Becky the Loon is, like, laughed at and mocked, and, like, Gerald the Sea Lion is laughed at and mocked, and they're both these, like, kind of derpy characters who don't seem to all be mentally there? Like, he made a very interesting point that, you know, this film is so sensitive about Dory's disability and how she functions in the world, and yet it kind of turns around and, like, makes fun of these characters who, like, look different and are being, like, mocked at and laughed. I thought it was a really interesting point.
Hmm. Yeah, I didn't think about that. Sea lions are known to be a little dim.
Well, they're also known to be jerks. I mean, yeah, they're jerks. The two jerk sea lions in this are very
distinct. That was a running joke that scored every time for me.
And that was our Wire reunion, too, of Dominic West, mm-hmm, and Idris Elba.
Idris Elba
were the two sea lions.
Really? It's funny, the things that you're... Some deep part of me, like, resents whenever we talk about a lesser Pixar movie as though it's a humongous disappointment, because, you know, they've done so many wonderful things. They've brought so much joy into our lives. And when they come along with one of their B movies, like, I want to be supportive. I want to not be that person who's like, how dare you entertain me less than you've entertained me in the past. But at the same time, when I find myself distracted by stuff like those two sea lions and how much they reminded me of the mine seagulls, or the squid thing and how much it reminded me of the shark chase, I don't know, some little part of me dies, because I would rather be the person who watches this movie with, like, joy and wonder.
Regarding any Pixar, I would rather watch this than almost everything else that's going to come out for kids animated-wise this year. So
we saw a trailer for this film called Monster Trucks, Scott.
What about Storks?
Yeah, Storks.
Yeah, so we can at least say that about Pixar, which is even their B efforts, which I think we all agree.
It's like pizza. Yeah. Even when it's bad, it's good.
I've had some really incredibly bad pizza. Like, I've had pizza that...
Would you say it was the Cars 2 of pizza?
I would say it's the Planes, Fire, and Rescue of pizza, is what I would say.
The first film I took my daughter to, because I figured, you know, I wasn't sure she was going to behave or not. I figured this is a low stakes. If I walk out of Planes, Fire, and Rescue, what have I really lost, you know?
And did she turn to you and say, Father, why didn't you take me to one of the A-list Pixars instead? Well, while we're talking about the various nitpicky objections we had, Scott, we can transition into your topic. I believe you had something to say about the way internal logic works in both this and Memento.
Yes. Pairing Memento with Finding Dory wound up highlighting one of Finding Dory's biggest flaws to me, which is the failure to honor its own internal logic. Memento may pile gimmicks on top of gimmicks between its anterior grade amnesia and its crisscross chronologies, but Christopher Nolan is rigorous about dotting every I and crossing every T. Finding Dory besets Dory with a similar condition, but whenever the film writes itself into a corner, Dory always recovers some scrap of memory or intuition that gets the film out of it. And some of that is part of the film's emotional ballast. I mean, if we're to take Finding Dory as an allegory about a special needs child, then we can see as progress her ability to hold on to memories that she by nature would forget. But it's frustrating to watch this narrative lurch forward again and again and again out of convenient moments of lucidity on her part. So that's a really fundamental problem. And I think that's why I think Dory is so much more effective as a supporting character than as a main character, because to have something centered around her really is constantly putting the writers in a position where they're going to have to figure out how to get her out of scrapes. And I don't think they find elegant solutions for that as often as they should.
I feel like both films cheat a little bit on the exact ways in which the memory condition works. Mm. Memento cheats a little bit in exactly how long it takes him to reset. And Nolan's made it clear that it's because if he's focusing on something, he can maintain attention longer. If he's in the middle of something particularly intense, he can maintain attention longer. But by and large, my understanding from his description is that it's supposed to, an individual segment is supposed to take about 15 minutes. The movie segments take about 5. So you're already cheating a little bit there. And then, you know,
that's a very, I think that's a pretty minor.
Oh, yeah. It's certainly a minor cheat. But in the same way, I think Finding Dory like messes a little bit with exactly what she can remember and when. The one defense I have for that is that it's actually consistent with Finding Nemo. That was one of the things that surprised me most about going back and rewatching Nemo, mm-hmm. was she also has the same kind of like abrupt triggered flashbacks where she does apparently store all of these memories and can access them when she sees the right kind of thing or the right kind of conditions happen. So yes, I think it's cheaty. I think it's at least a semi-consistent cheat. But I agree with your objection.
I mentioned this in the first part, the line about Dory's inability to form new memories kind of giving her a strange power to move through life. Are any of you familiar with the term reckless optimism? It's basically the idea that like optimism is not grounded in belief that you'll achieve a desired outcome. It's a determination to reevaluate the situation on a moment-to-moment basis and acknowledge the possibilities inherent in that moment. And I think Dory's ability to kind of move through life and get out of scrapes kind of is an extension of that idea. And I do know people that do seem to kind of succeed despite themselves throughout life. And I find Dory to be kind of in line with that sort of person, and they do tend to have the best stories and do have the most adventures. It's not something that I understand in my own life and the way I move through the world, but I kind of get it in relation to Dory. Does any of that make sense?
No.
There's a weird thread throughout the movie that's specifically about Dory's anxiety. And I feel like the film is very conscious about how it's dealing with her memory loss as a handicap and how other people relate to her as a handicapped character by resenting her and judging her and expecting them to live up to their ability and then coming around on the fact that, you know, she is who she is and that's fine. But what interested me more and what I think is in a way like more applicable is that she's a really anxious character and that when she gets upset about her own disability is when she gets more anxious and then creates this anxiety spiral. And it kind of seems ironic to me that so much of that what would Dory do kind of idea is all about like, let's ignore any thoughts we have about this problem. Let's ignore any fears we have about this problem and just charge recklessly forward at the first thing that we see. Like some part of that just felt very anti-intellectual to me in a way I found a little disturbing.
Yeah. I guess. But it's also, as someone who is an anxious person and who does overanalyze, as a Marlin, basically, I do respond to the romance of that notion of being able to just barrel through life, come hell or high water.
Live in the moment.
Yeah. As you say, when Dory is not doing that is when she... when her disability kind of overcomes her and she falls victim to it.
Keith, it occurs to me that this looks like a really good way to transition into your topic, which is memory and identity. I mean, both of these are characters who are very much defined by their memory losses. What do you think these films say about identity?
I think there's kind of a terrifying notion at the bottom of both films, especially Memento, but I think it's implied in Finding Dory that without our memories, we really have no identity. And both Leonard and Dory kind of desperately cling to and try to restore what they have of their lives, you know, in various ways, either atone for a past misdeed in the case of Finding Nemo or in Dory trying to return herself to the family that gave her her identity. Well, I mean, in some ways, Dory illustrates it just as well as Memento in those opening segments where she's just kind of drifting off and physically drifting further and further from her parents, but also having less and less a sense of who she is. There's kind of a sense that she's moved from situation to situation. The only thing that kind of restores her sense of self is when she meets Marlin and is kind of taken in as another member of their family. And as the film opens here, she's almost like, in some ways, like the family pet, you know, who gets up and must be taken care of.
Guys, is there any particular reason you can especially relate to that?
Gets up at 5:15 reliably every morning, demands to be taken out, barks at you. Oh, I know, that's getting too autobiographical here. You know, Leonard is interesting in that he tasks himself with keeping this sort of skeleton of his personality and of his past alive, even if it means in some ways lying to himself about who he was, because he has to sculpt out a new sense of who he needs to be. There's a part when he's talking about Sammy Jenkins and really talking about himself where he describes the wife's trying to decide, you know, she needs to know that the old him is totally gone. And maybe she can love this new Sammy, but is there even anyone there? If you have no ability to retain any sort of sense of what's going on, who are you at that point? I think that's a really interesting question that both films raise in different ways. You know, watching Memento and the more we talked about it, I really am glad we paired these movies together, even though they don't necessarily immediately feel like they belong together.
Yeah, I mean, as far as how memory gives these characters a sense of self, maybe that's kind of a missing element in Finding Dory, or maybe an advantage that Memento has, since he has opposable thumbs, to be able to create this system and be able to create himself on the spot. You know, he's not just living in the moment like Dory and just sort of following intuition. He's got a system, and so that kind of separates the two characters. And I think there's also something much more fundamental to Dory. There's a fundamental decency and helpfulness and spirit that is with her no matter what she forgets. I mean, she is. So I think she does have a pretty strong identity or personality, you know, without needing to create it or to have these memories that inform it in any way.
Andrew Stanton's talked about how, like, one of the kind of defining things about Dory is that she's created that helpful, upbeat, open personality for herself as a response to her condition, because it helps her make friends quickly and it helps her deal with what can be a very depressing life. I mean, she's kind of gone through her life on this quest. We see her over and over trying to ask strangers for help in getting back to she doesn't know where, to recover something that she doesn't know what she's lost. And if she hadn't invented this personality for herself, like, her life would be pretty dire.
It reminds me of what we were talking about with Leonard and how he does have this sort of likable, approachable personality that is a bit of a put on in order to interact with people and move through life.
Yeah, the glimmer of recognition.
Yeah. But even beyond that, he's a self-made, like, he's a self-created being. Mm-hmm. He's put all of these elements into his life specifically to shape who he's going to be, because he knows that he's not going to be able to form his own identity in the moment. So he's got to form his own identity for the next moment and the next moment down the line.
I have a related question. Who is Leonard after the movie ends, after the narrative ends here, because he's revealed to himself or tricked himself into believing he's accomplished what he needs to do. Where does Leonard go now?
I mean, that's a really good question. He, again, that whole idea of this movie having some very blatant moments that might not play in a movie that wasn't structured this way. He says several times that he needs a system. He needs a function. He needs a purpose. He needs, it doesn't matter whether he remembers taking vengeance. All that matters is that it happens. He has all of these principles that he lives by, and they're all kind of tied to the idea of giving himself a quest to give himself an identity. Mm-hmm. You know, given that he's setting out to get the tattoo on his chest that says, I did it, I don't know who he is. And I think that's the reason that the story ends where it ends.
Yeah. And you know, you don't want to speculate. It's outside the scope of the movie, but I did find myself thinking, well, what happens to this guy next?
I mean, has anybody else read the Jonathan Nolan short story?
Mm-hmm, no.
Like, it's pretty dire. I mean, it's the character pretty much sitting in a hospital room, like, reading all of these notes to himself. There's not a whole lot to his life. And the story spells out, you know, you can't hold a job. You can't make friends. You can't have a relationship. You can't have children. Like, there's not a whole lot going for him. There's not a whole lot to keep him moving forward. In that way, I find Finding Dory a little depressing, in part because, you know, in Finding Nemo, she says to Marlin, you're my home now. I remember better when I'm around you. Mm-hmm. I feel comfortable when I'm around you. And then at the beginning of Finding Dory, she just kind of dumps that out the window. Mm. You know, she's got this relationship that is defining her identity. And then she remembers another one and she kind of goes, yeah, see ya. I got people I barely remember somewhere else. I got to be with them.
You don't have a movie without that, though. You
know? Well, and our past is part of our identity, and that is something that Memento plays very heavily on with his wife and their attack and how he got his condition to begin with. You know, it's significant that the only thing he can remember is the past, and that is what informs his present. You know, like what he is doing is all because of something that happened in the past. And with finding Dory, it's a search for roots, I guess, a search for what made you the way you are. And in this case, that's her parents. I mean, I buy that.
I mean, it's not that I don't buy it. I do think that a more powerful motivator for me than I have to get back to my parents is that she's like well aware that they loved her and that they will be terribly, terribly worried about her.
Yeah.
And like that to me is to the degree that this film has an emotional hook, it's there. And to the degree that Memento feels lost and lonely, it's because somewhere in his heart he wants to go back. Well, very blatantly, he wants to go back to this relationship that defined him and that he can't go back to. Although you talk about what he can remember is the past, so much of what we see about him remembering the past isn't real.
Yeah.
That it kind of makes me question some of the other stuff. Like his, again, he tells Natalie, you know, this memories that he has of his wife are kind of like what defines him. And I can't help but wonder how real they are, too, and whether they're also a fantasy.
I find that quick shot of him in bed with his wife with I've Done It tattooed on his chest really poignant, because this is total fantasy, but at the same time, you know, this is all he has and doesn't even really have it.
Well, that kind of ties into my topic, which is mystery. What interests me most, I think, about these two films is the way they unfold in ways that only reveal what the audience needs to know as we need to know it. They're both stories that unfold, one of them backward in time, one of them forward in time, but both of them just function from reveal to reveal to reveal. Scott, I think you're entirely right in that the reveals in Finding Dory are a little cheaty and a little gimmicky, but I still think it's interesting how we get one piece of the puzzle at the time. We don't know what separated Dory from her family. We just know that it happened, and we only get that piece as it comes together. As much as Finding Dory cheats a little around her memories, I actually think it's really interesting how it's structured around physical items, physical objects, places, the kinesthetics of places, the like the smells and the sights and the sounds of the world. Mm-hmm. It uses all of these things to remind her of like who she is and where she's come from. And it I said in my review for The Verge, it explains mysteries that nobody was really waiting to be explained, like why she thinks she can speak whale and where she got her little song from. And I didn't necessarily need those gaps filled in, but it is interesting to see how both of these movies kind of function as puzzles, putting together pieces that you didn't even necessarily know were missing until you're handed the puzzles. I think Memento is vastly superior in that way, in that there are so many more puzzles and in the way they're so much more relatable, but they're also almost more puzzle pieces than you need to form a complete picture. Memento becomes not just about the mysteries that are solved, but the mysteries that are muddled and confused by the extra pieces. And you have to figure out what pieces to discard to get a complete picture.
I mean, what you're saying about Finding Dory almost makes me want to walk back ever so slightly what I was saying about the internal logic of Finding Dory, because there you didn't like
what I just I was like saying. It when you admit you're wrong.
I'm just gonna slightly. I'm not going to say I'm wrong about the film cheating its way out of corners that it's written itself into. But what you're saying about the puzzle that is Dory's life and the how those pieces are laid out, that's a whole other story and something I kind of regret not mentioning. Something that works a little bit better for me than other scraps that help her on her way.
Well, I guess then here's a question for all of you. I think it's inevitable as you're watching Memento that you're going to constantly be thinking, what does that mean? Where did that come from? Why did he do this? Did any of you have that kind of curiosity with Finding Dory where you wanted to know what the pieces were missing?
No. I mean, I do think the stuff with her parents is the best stuff in the movie, but it wasn't necessarily like I need to satisfy some sort of need to find out what happened by seeing these scenes.
And here's the thing for me, I guess. I feel like with Finding Dory and with other like Pixar films that don't fully satisfy us, it may mostly come down to just an emotional letdown. And I kind of feel like our intellects struggle to catch up. And we look for like all of these like weird little nitpicky reasons that the film doesn't work for us. But I think in the end, it's just kind of an emotional letdown. And I feel like here the emotional letdown is the draw of her quest. Just, you know, there is a terror in a father who's lost his child, much less a father who's lost his handicapped child, who is the only child surviving of his family. I just never felt that kind of pull with Finding Dory. And I wonder if the real problem with the movie is that it doesn't emotionally draw us along either to unpack its mysteries or to hit its conclusion.
Well, I mean, one of the big problems is that it's a retread. Mm-hmm. I mean, what is the quest of the same? I mean, you have a single parents with one child.
Well, it's a quest in reverse.
It's a quest in reverse, right? So I mean, you could say that's an echo, but if you want to be generous about it, but
it's like Memento. It's the backward part, and Finding Nemo's the forward part.
It'd be great if it were one movie going one way and the other way and passing in the middle somehow. But yeah, but I mean, just the way that they're lost. I mean, Nemo gets caught in the drop off because of the drop off, and then Dory gets caught in the undertow, and it's like, why am I watching the same movie a second time?
Genevieve, you walked right up to the edge of your topic, which is specifically structure, and then we fell off the drop-off and didn't quite get back to it.
Yeah, I'll keep this brief because we've talked about a lot of what I wanted to bring up in talking about structure, but in true Finding Dory fashion, I have held back some important pieces of information, which I'm going to share with you now. We've talked a lot about Memento structure being kind of one of its defining features, but I want to highlight some interesting structural stuff that's going on in Finding Dory. There's a little mini interview with Andrew Stanton on IO9 titled How Finding Dory Learned from the Mistakes of Finding Nemo. And it talks about how Stanton ended up reworking his original version of Finding Nemo, which originally kept that opening moment where Marlin loses his family until the end of the movie and revealed it in flashback. It was moved to the beginning of the movie fairly late in Nemo's production, and Stanton says that he came away from that experience with the mantra of never tell flashbacks if you don't have to. Which is interesting in the case of Finding Dory, which is arguably very reliant on flashback. But, as his article points out, these moments from the past that we experience throughout the film aren't really traditional flashbacks because Dory is remembering them for the first time, effectively experiencing them in the present. We're not being denied information for the sake of the narrative. The revelation of the information is part of the narrative. And that aspect of the structure in particular struck me as very similar to Memento, this idea of the protagonist remembering something as effectively them and, by extension, us experiencing it for the first time. We've talked about how these moments are flashbacks, but does that explanation hold any water for you guys?
I'm sorry, I'm still reeling from the idea of not knowing what happened to Marlin's family till the end of the movie.
Yeah.
That would have been such a different film.
Yeah, apparently the reason they didn't want it at the beginning is it was just too heavy, too emotional of a beginning, which, you know, considering Up, you know, is funny, but this was obviously before Up. But they realized that Marlin's, you know, extreme anxiety and fear wasn't really fully explicable without that moment.
So. Sure. And just the idea of like coming along after that entire movie and saying, oh, and by the way, he really loves his son for reasons. Like, I don't know, after an hour and a half of that movie, you don't really need proof that he loves his son. Like, you don't really need that incident.
I think it could have worked, though. I think if anything, it would have been heavier to spread it out over the film like that.
But anyway, this idea that the flashbacks in Finding Dory aren't really flashbacks, they are events or being experienced in the present. What do you guys think of that?
Sophistry, I say. Sophistry!
Is it just Stanton kind of backing away from the rule that he set for himself and then apparently broke?
I mean, we were talking earlier about how like it's the same movie in reverse. I mean, I don't see anything wrong with deciding that the first movie we're not going to do flashbacks and in the second movie we're going to go all flashbacks. I think denying that an adult re-experiencing events from her childhood is a flashback. Like, yeah, sophistry.
I mean, I guess when I think of flashbacks, I think of someone looking into the distance and remembering something in the story, kind of pausing just for them to remember that. And that's not really what's happening here. Like, the memory is the event. It is happening in the present. And the reclamation of that memory is a plot point. The memory itself isn't necessarily the plot point. It's a very fine distinction, but I think in comparing this to Memento, which is very strongly tied to this idea of experiencing memory in the present, it's an interesting way to look at those flashbacks or not flashbacks.
Is it, though? I mean, is it an interesting way of looking at it?
Hey, you're the one who picked this pairing, Tasha.
Yeah, but you're the one who picked this topic. And more importantly, Stanton is the one that's trying to draw this particular line in the sand. I don't know. To me, this goes back to all of the feedback we had in segment one about Popstar and its particular brand of humor and what it's allowed to do and what it's not, and like the particular direction it's doing in. To me, it's like, does it matter if it's a flashback or not? Like, the real question is, does it work?
I'm still picking my pieces of my brain off the floor, so I don't have any opinion on it.
I just feel bad for Josh for Ohio.
Oh, poor Josh from Ohio. Well, Memento is available on Blu-ray in the 10th anniversary format and in a box set of Christopher Nolan films, but we're surprised to find out it isn't on any of the major streaming services. Sorry to put you guys out. It honestly had not occurred to us that such a celebrated film would not be available in every format imaginable. Finding Dory is currently in theaters, and it's likely to be around for a while after enjoying the biggest opening day and weekend for an animated feature ever. Much like Finding Nemo, which is still Pixar's all-time second highest box office earner ever, we may just not be in exactly the right boat for this one. By now, you should probably be able to find some relatively uncrowded theaters if you feel more of a pull to catch it. We'll be right back with our usual recommendation segment, Your Next Picture Show. Finally, it's time to catch each other up on films or film-related items we've seen in the interim since our last podcast. We call this Your Next Picture Show in the hopes that it'll put some interesting choices on your radar. Genevieve, you want to kick us off?
Yeah, I just wanted to give a quick recommendation for Suited, which is a new HBO documentary directed by Jason Benjamin and co-produced by Lena Dunham and Jenny Connor of Girls fame. It's ostensibly a profile of a custom suit company in Brooklyn called Bindle and Keep, but that's really just a framing device used to introduce Suited's real subjects, who are a handful of transgender and gender nonconforming individuals who have trouble finding clothing that reflects their true selves. It's a short, well-constructed documentary that uses as its guiding principle the idea that everyone who comes in for a fitting at this tailor has a story that brought them to that place, and it uses that fitting as a jumping-off point to tell this collection of personal stories about these people. I'm a big fan of fashion documentaries, which is why I was drawn to this film in the first place, but the fashion angle is really secondary to this sort of larger question of the ways we communicate how we want to be perceived by the world and how that specifically applies to the transgender and gender nonconforming community. It's an easy breezy watch. It doesn't have much of a critical viewpoint per se, but it's really touching, engaging as a sort of anthology of these personal stories. It debuted on HBO on June 20th. It should be rerunning for in the near future and available on HBO's various streaming platforms. So Suited, check it out.
Very cool. Scott?
So the Music Works Theater here in Chicago has been running a mini Brian De Palma retrospective, and I've been seeing as many movies as I can from it. But I wanted to recommend Phantom of the Paradise for those who haven't seen it. Seeing it after the documentary De Palma, which I recommended last week, I was struck by how much Phantom of the Paradise reflects De Palma's attitude about trying to make art in a business that distorts or destroys it. There's no more powerful scene in his films to me than Winslow Leach, the hero played by William Finley, you know, rolling a piano into a club and performing the title song for a cantata that he's written called Faust. For a few minutes, we see him completely lost in the ecstasy of pure artistic expression, while Swan, the diabolical record producer played by Paul Williams, makes plans for it in the darkness. Phantom of the Paradise then becomes this wild, grotesque cult musical about seeing Winslow's art and his face thoroughly ground up by the system. He keeps on fighting, though, and so does Brian De Palma.
Phantom of the Paradise is it's a bat poop crazy movie.
It's so good.
It's a lot of fun.
It really is. I'm happy that Rocky Horror is what Rocky Horror is, but it would have been something if in an alternate universe, if Phantom of the Paradise had been that a phenomenon of that kind, because it really deserves that kind of following, which it has in Canada.
Was yeah,
in
Canada? Winnipeg.
Winnipeg, yeah.
I was going to say the alternate universe is actually Winnipeg.
Winnipeg, yeah. They love it there.
I remember that as being like Nicholas Winding Refn levels of like visual color saturation. Am I wrong in that?
Yeah, a little bit. A little wrong. it's not. It's got some striking visuals, but not necessarily in the realm of color so much as framing and in a split screen and the usual De Palma tricks. So what about you, Tasha?
Speaking of bat poop crazy movies, when we were first came up with the idea of doing Finding Dory, my husband said, "Oh, you should pair it with this movie, The Swimmer," which apparently none of us had seen and I had never even heard of, but we happened to have it at home. So we pulled it out and watched it together. This is a 1968 movie starring Burt Lancaster. It was directed by Frank Perry, who also directed Mommy Dearest. It's an adaptation of a very short John Cheever short story. And it is a movie about a man in the 60s who realizes that all of his friends have swimming pools and that technically, if he walks from pool to pool, he can swim his way home. And it becomes this sort of psychodrama about it, like as though he were a salmon returning to his place of birth as he travels across the landscape of all of these people who have very, let's just say, very different relationships to him, basically encountering them in order to use their pools on this really chaotic quest to swim his way home. As the film unfolds, it becomes this really strange kind of psychedelic 60s drama. There's a little bit of the party in there. There's a little bit of kind of melodrama. There's a little bit of, I don't know, Splendor in the Grass. It's all kinds of different films wrapped up into one. And it's very, very strange, but it's so compelling and it's so deeply, deeply weird. The closer he gets to home, the more this film starts to have things in common with Memento and Finding Dory, the more it becomes clear that there are matters of memory and identity and choice and self-creation going on, and the less the world cooperates with the protagonist's attempts to recreate himself. It's a very strange film. It's incredibly memorable. Burt Lancaster gives a really incredible performance as a man who's mostly nude and dripping wet for the entirety of this film. 1968's The Swimmer. Can't recommend it enough.
I've always meant to see that, and I've never done so.
Oh, Scott, I want so badly to know what you would think of this movie.
I'll give it a shot.
It's so strange. Keith, what do you have for us?
I guess I've kind of got a movie that I've always meant to see and then never did. And then I did, which was Here Comes Mr. Jordan, which I knew for years as the inspiration for the Warren Beatty film Heaven Can Wait, which is a film I like a lot. And the original is if anything, even better. It's a delightful 1941 film starring Robert Montgomery as a boxer who also enjoys piloting planes and dies in a plane crash and is taken to the afterlife by a supernatural functionaries, I guess is a way to put it. Except he's taken too soon. He would have survived the crash. And so Claude Rains, as they're never called angels, they're never even referred to as heaven or the afterlife and nothing explicitly, religion explicitly laid out. But Claude Rains is another high ranking afterlife person who puts him back into the body of a millionaire who's just been murdered. And there's sort of a delightful comedy and romance. But I don't know. It's very sweet. Clever movie. Montgomery is a lot of fun in it, as is James Gleason as his trainer and the only person that knows that he's actually the boxer in another body. But you know, it was part of a run of supernatural comedies. You know, it's not as good as Powell and Pressburger's Stairway to Heaven or A Matter of Life and Death, which really takes this notion of returning from the beyond to live on Earth to really profound levels. But it's a lot of fun and kind of a comforting vision of the afterlife, where you know, things may not always work out on Earth, but there is a larger forces at work that are really do kind of want to look after our happiness. And it's new out on Blu-ray from Criterion, so it's filled out with some nice extras and it looks great, and that's why I would recommend Here Comes Mr. Jordan.
Yeah, I watched that quite a while ago, and it's sort of this weird part and parcel of it. It seems like there was just this whole period, and you named a bunch of them, mm-hmm. of these movies about about the afterlife as just kind of a very practical place where very benevolent forces get fairly involved in, like, often bringing people back to life to further explore things. Like, what was going on back then with people in the afterlife?
I mean, part of it, I think, is this film was quite successful, and also this film came out in 1941 on the eve of World War II, and sort of a sense that people who had been through, you know, so many people had been through one World War already, and there's another one looming, and kind of getting comfortable with the idea of losing people. I mean, it's a lighthearted film, but it's also a film about, you know, the people that we lose and what happens to them. And it's nicely balanced that way. If you want to go down the whole rabbit hole of confusion explore the fact that this is based on a play called Heaven Can Wait. And that title was not used because there's an Ernst Lubitsch movie called Heaven Can Wait, which remade as Heaven Can Wait. It has a sequel called Down to Earth. When it was remade a second time with Chris Rock, that film was called Down to Earth. But Down to Earth was itself remade as, wait for it, a film called Xanadu. It's Keith, a very strange history.
That was the most, like, detailed, thoughtful, and informative answer I think I've ever gotten to a flippant question. Thank you for that.
Sure.
That was really impressive. That's it for this week's edition of the Next Picture Show. Our next episodes come out July 12th and 14th. Keith, you want to tell us what we have lined up?
Next week, we're going to talk about a pair of films that offer lurid takes on the theme of female rivalry. A bunch of us saw Nicholas Winding Refn's new The Neon Demon, in which Elle Fanning stars as a teen model alone in the wilds of the fashion industry in Los Angeles. We're pairing that film with Dario Argento's 1977 shocker, Suspiria, which tells a similar and equally over-the-top story within the confines of an exclusive ballet school with a secret.
I'm looking forward to that one. In the meantime, we'd love to hear your feedback on this week's discussion of Memento, Finding Dory, and anything else film-related. We want to include your thoughts on future episodes of the show. You can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. Finally, before closing out this week's episode, where can we find everyone these days? Keith?
I'm at uprocks.com, where I'm heading up film and television coverage and writing when I can. Oh, and on Twitter at kphipps3000.
You can find me on Twitter at @Scott_Tobias, and you can find my work at NPR, Variety, New York Times, Washington Post, Rolling Stone, Vulture, Village Voice, Uprocks, and I'm the editor-in-chief of Oscilloscope's Musings.
Genevieve?
And I'm on Twitter at Genevieve Kosky. Tasha, how about you?
You can find me writing about film at TheVerge.com. Most recently, you can find some stuff that I wrote at NPR for the Read, Watch, Binge recommendation program. You can find me on Twitter at Tasha Robinson. And you can stay updated on The Next Picture Show via Twitter at Next Picture Pod, via Facebook at Facebook.com/Next Picture Show, or by visiting NextPictureShow.net. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to the show on iTunes. And while you're there, think about rating and reviewing us. Every thumbs up helps us find new listeners and keep the show going. Thanks to Colin the Animal Griffith for his assistance producing the show, and thanks to Delmark Records for providing recording space at their home base, Riverside Studios. The Next Picture Show is proud to be part of the Film Spotting family of podcasts and the Panoply Network. Please tune in next time.